I'm very happy to welcome back to the program David Olson. He is the artistic director of Theater Work, and Theater Work is presenting The Rug Merchants of Chaos, a play by Ronald Ribman, opening this Friday. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Good morning. Good to see you.
Good to see you, too. Now, Theater Work, a wonderful theater company here in Santa Fe, is doing this play that is set in the mid-1980s, and it's basically, it's almost people stranded on a desert island. There are people on a ship, two couples escaping from a crime. Set up the story for us.
Well, they definitely are trying to escape. We come in on them after they've been bouncing from one failed enterprise that's just going to make them a pile of money after the other. And the latest one was investing in a bunch of cheap carpets and trying to sell them cheaply to people. And finally, no one would buy them. The things would fall apart. There's one moment they describe that one of them has butterfly patterns, and at the first foot swipe, the wings and antenna disappear. So not such good rugs.
Not so good.
And so they have a warehouse full of these things, and they decide that the best way out might be just to sort of burn the carpets to offload the burden of those carpets and head out for something else. Well, unfortunately, not just the carpets burn. We're given to believe that the building, the warehouse, catches fire. We don't know how far that fire has gone, but in any case, off they go. They're in, of all places, Cape Town, South Africa, and the only boat, or what seems to be a boat, floating thing that's leaving the harbor is what they think is a freighter. Turns out to be a garbage scow. In other words, a rusty hulk that's heading out just to dump the garbage. And on it they get. They've paid a great amount of money to get out of town. We can hear the sirens and see the flames in the distance. And there they are once again, another failed business. We come to, though, understand these people really well, I think.
Indeed. Two couples. One couple is basically just a born businessman and a schemer who wants to make a bunch of money and always has a great vision and may not be so practical or realistic or good on the follow-through.
Not at all good on the follow-through. He can convince anyone, apparently, of anything. That's his gift. Gift of gab. As you say, he can get very enthusiastic. We see him a few times in the play getting very enthusiastic about new schemes and possibilities. And we come to understand that, yeah, if you didn't know him very well, you could think, oh, listen to this guy. He's really got it going. He's a businessman. He's an entrepreneur. He's all those things. And he's deeply in love with his wife, which is really interesting to watch, I think, too, and that sort of starts to mitigate how we understand this guy, who on his own, you might think, what a con artist.
And she's very much in love with him, and
very
she's a
much.
Southern belle who, no matter how bad things get, looks perfectly put together, and her hair and her nails and her little high-heeled shoes and her shorts are just never a stitch out of place.
Every time she looks in her first appearance, which happens soon after we hear sirens and see flames in the background, first comes the other woman onto the boat, carrying everything she could grab haphazardly, willy-nilly from her house. None of it makes any sense whatsoever, but there she is, layers of clothing. And then comes this other woman.
The Southern Belle.
The Southern woman, Annie, looking as though she were invited for the weekend onto the Kennedy's yacht.
Right.
And somehow, we don't know how, they only had minutes to get it together, but somehow we discover in the course of the play, which basically covers about a 24-hour period, that she had everything she needed for, a cruise. And we don't know how, we decided that she must have had it packed at all times,
right,
ready to go.
Which is something that many of us have thought of doing, but few have ever actually
right.
done. Now, the other couple somehow got involved with these two first people who we've just been talking about. They met at a rest stop somewhere, at a taco stand, got talking and got sort of drawn into the idea of getting rich quick and doing these enterprises. And they are at least the wife, well, both of them, more sort of college-educated people who followed along at their own peril for years and years. And the wife, Sheila, has to be one of the most annoying people in the history of theater. Characters, I mean.
She seems to be. I, of course, have been working with Sheila for many weeks, so I've come to sort of like her.
Really? But,
I wanted
to throw tomatoes at her. I was in the rehearsal last night.
Well, I think that's a... I understand why. She's determined to see the worst. She's determined to see the bad in things. But I think there is a moment in the play I don't necessarily want to hand it over.
Give it away,
I think people need to hear it in her voice. And in the midst of all of this chaos, we could talk about what chaos is in the play, too. There's a couple of chaoses there. But there's a moment in which she expresses her response to her husband's saying to her that perhaps his suffering, he's a Vietnam veteran who was responsible for a little platoon of men and had to drag them out of the jungle himself and that sort of thing. Some of them didn't come out. And he seems to say to her that his suffering or his what he experienced was somehow more grave, more complex than what she experiences. And she responds, I think, very poignantly to that. And when I heard that out loud, of course, I had read the play many, many times before starting and made a plan and knew where I was going. But when I heard it aloud the first time, something opened inside me. And I think the play is like that. It's filled with all kinds of layers and levels, and things come bursting through all of a sudden, as can happen when you're with a person. You know, they're grumbling and grousing, and then they say something that takes you to a moment that you haven't seen, but that begins to explain them to you, and your attitude may soften, or at least you are willing to listen further. And I think that character is like that's beautifully played.
Very, very well played.
By Kat Sawyer, a very accomplished actor who really has devoted herself to getting inside Kat and not mitigating those qualities that you're talking about you might want to throw a tomato at.
Yeah, you want to throw her overboard,
it's
honestly.
It's hard to do that in a way for an actor to not present himself or herself as likable.
Really?
I think so.
I've always wondered what it would be like to play a villain. Not that I'm an actor, because I'm not, but if you have the role of the person that everybody's going to hate.
Yeah. Well, a villain is one thing, because I think a villain is all the role of a villain is all set up so that we understand that right from the beginning, we go with it. We know we're meant to be irritated or angered or disturbed by that character. But in the case of Sheila Finkelberg, Sheila doesn't know that about herself at all. In fact, Sheila on the inside is extremely vulnerable and open to being susceptible to the things around her. And so the actor, in this case, has to play both. She has to not arm herself internally and have this armor that she's trying to erect, I would say not very successfully, on the outside to protect herself. In fact, she's even carrying stuff that's meant to protect her. She even insists on wearing a great big old sealskin coat in 110-degree weather on this miserable, stinky garbage scow of a boat. Because why? Not because she's vain, but because she feels that it will offer her some protection and some way through all of this. It has a value, she says, and she doesn't just mean monetary. She means that in some ways it gives her a kind of presence and a kind of, you know, status, which is important to her. She keeps telling us that she's a Bennington graduate.
Right. Yeah, and it's the questions of what status means and what education means, and really what anything means when you're in a dire situation where nobody cares about those things and where other values, like knowing how to fix a motor or knowing how to survive in various ways, come to the fore.
Yes, knowing when you're out in the middle of the ocean and you have no way out of there, no way forward, and can't go back, what do you do? I mean, it reflects, doesn't it, back onto other stories and pieces of literature and so on, where people are caught on water, you know, or have to cross over water into a new life. So this particular playwright knows both the crazy chaos that, you know, Lucy and Desi and Fred and Ethel knew. And he also clearly knows, and has studied the chaos of the Greeks, which is this other chaos where one could fall into emptiness, fall into nothing.
Right. So that chaos, explain more about that in what chaos means in the Greek sense.
Well, in the Greek sense, it's that notion that the surrounding me somehow is the entirely other, and that everything I have or have pretended to be or know makes no difference if I enter it. So it's not a place of torture or a place of horror. Torture and horror would give me something to chew on, something to resist, something to suffer. But chaos in the Greek sense, as Ribman presents it, is, as I say, this place where nothing that I carry with me would make a difference. And so it's to be annihilated. In other words, to disappear. So that chaos, now I said in the program, but I quoted what I imagined an audience member saying, hey, I thought this was supposed to be a comedy. Well, it is. It is a comedy. There are great comedians, if you think of the great comedians, who could portray both the foolishness and the goofiness and the absurdity of the things that can happen to us. And then somewhere through that, you look at them or you see them on the screen or even on the little screen. There were characters that, you know, that I've seen even on television who in certain series or comedic series that actually at times break open and you see them struggling. And I'm very drawn, of course, to that, those levels of performing, because that's what I do. I work in the theater, and we're interested in not presenting stereotypes and you know, things that are already answered before anybody sits down, but presenting experiences that are in some way transformative, that the audience person takes a little trip with us for a couple of hours. I don't just mean that figuratively. I mean, actually, you know, it starts at 7:30, and by 9:30, we've listened to and seen and felt and remembered a lot. I hope that's what theater, I think, is still for. It's different from TV, of course, or film, because it's live.
Right. And you have it set up. We're talking, by the way, to David Olson of Theater Work about the play The Rug Merchants of Chaos, which is opening this Friday. And it's at the James A. Little Theater. And like some of the other plays that you've done there, you have it set up where the audience is sitting on the stage in a kind of, do you call them bleachers?
Risers.
Risers that you've set up.
It's very similar.
Very intimate.
Yes, it's very intimate. We felt that this play really required that. Again, a wonderful challenge to the actors to be utterly visible, because you can even see their pupils dilate. You can see...
Are your actors so good that they can make their pupils dilate?
I don't think it's that they can make them do it. I think they do know, however, how to enter into a moment so intensely that you can see it. I mean, when I sit there watching, I'm often amazed. I can see a tear form in Jack Sherman's eye long before the character admits to what he's angry about or hasn't said before but needs somehow now to say. So long before he says it, I can see a tear appearing in the corner of an eye. And then a few seconds, maybe some many seconds later, out comes the line and out comes the tear. And it's nothing he's calculating. It's something, you know, he's been with theater work since he was 19. He's, you know, over 50 now. He works and works and works at being an actor.
So, amazing.
You know, when the audience arrives at the theater, they may not realize that the actors have been there already for an hour. And they're not sitting, or at least that, and they're not sitting backstage kind of having a cigarette and chatting and, you know, texting. They come in and they have a full warm-up period, which is really not just exercises or something. They do it independently all at once in the same room, out in the hall, actually. But they are actually warming up. It's a simple way of saying it, voice, body, so on. But also warming up those internal spaces, opening, yeah. opening. So that by the time the lights go up on Act One, they're fully there. They don't just start getting there when they walk onto the stage. They're there already. And that's just good acting process. I mean, that's not anything mysterious, or I wouldn't hope not unique to theater work, but it's certainly a value that we have at theater work, that actors are very ready when the play begins.
There is in this play not only the theme of chaos, but also the theme of faith against all odds. And
wow.
It's very interesting to see these two, especially the two female characters, the men too, but Sheila, the realist, pessimist complainer, against Annie, who we might think is not that bright, but has faith and really far more practicality when you look at it. When you look at it realistically, than her college-educated counterpart.
Far, far more. She's more what we call these days, or used to call, grounded, by which I mean she literally is in the world. She's in the moment. You see her, one of the first things she does when she gets into this hideous so-called lounge, which is really has been a storeroom filled with trash furniture that this captain, in an effort to, you know, charge these people a lot of money to get out of town, has just pushed this crap aside, this stuff aside.
And that's their cabin
that
they paid big money for.
And that's their cabin that they paid $8,000 for. And so one of the first things she does, she looks around, she sees what it is, but she's carrying a little Picasso print, and she sees a spot up on top of this filthy refrigerator, and she places very carefully her little Picasso print up there. Not in an effort to show off or anything, but in an effort to make things look a little better. And it's quite charming. And when I say charming, I mean strongly as you can use that word. Eventually, I think she's the character that one would wish you had with you in a bad situation, because she looks for the possible. She's always saying, well, this isn't so bad, you know, and she's sitting on this steaming, you know, some would think even sort of a cooking deck at the beginning of Act Two. And she's putting on suntan lotion. She's got a little sunning outfit on. And her little sunglasses. And there's nothing to read on this ship except old and girly magazines. So she's discovered for herself that there actually are articles in these magazines. I looked at one, and there is a pretty interesting article in one of them. If you can, you know, get yourself past the pictures. So, you know, it's very interesting, I think, that Ribman has put this kind of what I would call, quoting Paul Tillich, courage to be in the character of Annie, who seems shallow at first, what we would normally call shallow. I would say not shallow at all, actually. But you have to watch and watch and watch to realize why not.
Right.
How that surface belies the interior.
It sort of reminded me of something that I used to see. There were women who called themselves feminists and made a lot of noise, and then there were women who didn't do any of the things that feminists were supposed to do, so they looked very girly.
Yeah.
But they were strong and got just what they wanted and had a kind of fearlessness and perhaps faith also. Mm-hmm. And when I noticed that contrast way back when I was in my 20s, I kind of took it to heart and said, okay, surfaces don't tell you anything. It's what people do.
I was just thinking that in the play, Annie embodies the capacity for courage. She even speaks to it at one point. But courage, I think, has to do with hope, always. And again, this theologian, philosopher Tillich, in The Courage to Be, talks about courage being the hope that comes after hope is lost. And I think that character, and I think Ribman, let's talk about the playwright. I think the playwright must know something very deeply about that. I think he does, because I think he's written a play that, while it touches on the goofy stereotypes of television and film and so on, actually pushes way past that, but not all at once and not finally, but it keeps pushing past it. I mean, every once, you know, in the midst of all the goofiness and silliness of Sheila and her whining and so on, in the midst of that, right in the middle of it, we suddenly hear something that is a way through. If she could only hear it,
right?
You know,
the play is called The Rug Merchants of Chaos, and it opens this Friday, the 18th of February at 7:30, and runs this weekend and next weekend. So this weekend it's Friday and Saturday at 7:30, Sunday at 2 in the afternoon, and then the following weekend, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at 7:30, and Sunday at 2, James A. Little Theater. For tickets, you can call 471-1799. You can email mail@theaterwork.org or just go to the website theaterwork.org. David Olson is the Artistic Director of Theater Work. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
I really appreciate your interest in theater. Thanks.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.